Today, we present an interview with Asif Weiss. Asif, a Torah scholar and newfound friend of the podcast, joins to discuss his views, his history, and his approach to life in the Jewish faith. Hopefully, even if you're not someone familiar with the Torah, Judaism, or religion in general, you can enjoy our discussion. This is the first of many discussions with various people about things they find interesting, drive their passions, and ignite their lives. We call these episodes To Elucidate On, coming from the central word elucidate, an attempt to make things more clear. Enjoy. My first kind of idea that I wanted to kind of touch on, just because I know a little bit about you from what we've talked about, but I'd like to know a little bit about your background. Where does your like main position from your beliefs come from? Like, tell me a little bit, give me like a Cole's Notes history about you. Because I love everything I don't know about you so far is really neat, really, really cool. And I think you're an awesome guy. But I'd love to know more about like kind of how you got started in this. Because you even just mentioned a few minutes ago, we were talking how before you were observing, you were a bit of a different person. So kind of give me like a little bit of an insight to you and sort of what kind of got you started in this whole thing.
Okay, awesome. I guess I'll introduce myself first. Okay, my name's Asif Weiss. I'm from Huntington, New York. It's on Long Island in Suffolk County. Pretty much when I was born, my parents weren't especially observant Jews. Mm-hmm. They were more traditional. My mom comes from France, and her parents also were very, very traditional in Jewish values. And also my dad, his parents were Holocaust survivors, so he grew up in New Jersey with kind of in that generation of Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. But when I was born, they weren't especially observant. When I was about 7, let's say, my parents began to take some classes on Jewish thought, Jewish philosophy, Jewish law. And then together they decided to take their Judaism a little more seriously. They started learning Torah, right, the Bible. They started implementing the values into their lives. We started taking Shabbat more seriously, things like keeping kosher, and just, you know, kind of changing the house a little bit, you know, to just kind of be surrounded by Jewish values, taking the holidays more seriously. So I started going to a Jewish school when I started going to like an observant school when I was in first grade.
Okay.
So my whole life I just grew up with those values that my parents were instilling in mm-hmm. me, like observant values. But as any kid at that age, first grade through even middle school, I was really just doing what I was learning at school in terms of holidays and keeping kosher and Jewish values and what I see at home. And it was really in high school, I guess, when I wasn't necessarily questioning things at all. Mm-hmm. I was always a believer in the Jewish religion.
Right.
But I guess I just, you know, I went to school in the city. I dormed there. So I guess I just kind of started, I was more like enticed by secular society, partying, going to concerts, things like that. And I never like left the path of Judaism completely, but I definitely was not making it a priority in my life at all. Mm-hmm. I would go to a lot of music festivals. I would go on tour with bands, with like jam bands, like with Fish and members of the Grateful Dead and things mm-hmm. like that. I would
nice.
Follow them.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a lot of fun. That was like my senior year of high school. I spent a year after high school in Israel. I mm-hmm. Was officially in like a yeshiva setting, which is like a place of also studying Jewish things. But I didn't take things more seriously. That was really just like a year of partying still.
Sure.
And then in college, I went to Queens College. And in college, really, when I lived on my own and no one was telling me what to do anymore for the first time in my life, really, my parents weren't telling me to do any type of Jewish things. I wasn't in a school that was instilling them upon me and taking attendance on if I was going to prayers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I realized for the first time in my life as a freshman in college, I could really do whatever I wanted. I didn't have to do anything Jewish if I didn't want to. And I realized that I wanted to do them. Mm-hmm. I wanted to still be doing Shabbat, even though I wasn't doing it before so much, but I was like, oh, like now that I could choose to do it,
I shifted from like an obligation to a choice.
Right, exactly. And that was very freeing and very, it was like a confidence type of thing where it's like, no, I want to do this. Mm-hmm. And I still wasn't like especially observant or especially like ultra orthodox or ultra mm-hmm. observant, but I was definitely, you know, it's definitely like nice and balanced, I guess, in terms of like going to a secular college and also keeping kosher in my apartment with my roommates, keeping Shabbat. But still, we were still going out and partying on, say, on like Thursday nights and Saturday nights, but we would keep Shabbat more or less. And then really, I started learning, around my junior year, senior year of college, I started learning Talmud, which is a written documentation of the oral law.
Okay. Right?
Judaism, one of the like principles of Jewish faith is that the Jewish people got the Torah, the Bible, mm-hmm. right? The five books of Moses, call it that. That we got the five books of Moses at Mount Sinai. Mm-hmm. And alongside that, we got a running oral commentary. So we kind of had like the five books of Moses that Moshe brought down and said, here's the Torah. Mm-hmm. And alongside that, Moshe had an oral commentary saying like, oh, when the Torah says this thing, such as maybe something like tefillin, which is phylacteries, right? In the Torah, in the five books, the written Torah, it doesn't say what that looks like. It doesn't say what the obligation is. It just says where this thing called, it's called totafot in the Torah, but that really translates as phylacteries, like these boxes. You're familiar with these
things?
The boxes, and you strap them on your arm and on your head, and you wear the, a Jew usually wears them in the morning. A male would wear them in the morning. But it just says to do that. It says in the Torah, just wear them.
Mm-hmm.
And it says put one, them between your eyes and put one on your arm. But it doesn't say what it looks like. It doesn't say if anything's inside it. It doesn't say what it needs to be made out of, what color it is. It doesn't say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's kind of weird because it's like interesting because the Torah, the word Torah comes from, Torah is the five books, right?
Yes.
So the word Torah comes from the word hora'ah, mm-hmm. which means to teach.
Okay.
So the Torah is meant to be a teacher in a sense of how a Jew is supposed to live their life.
Okay.
So for something that's called a teacher, mm-hmm. the Torah, it's very vague in the sense that, for instance, it says where to fill in, but then it doesn't tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we have, when Moshe gave us the Torah, it was really, the Torah could be viewed more as like principles. Like these are the main principles of Judaism, but just like any type of intellectual study, you know what I mean? You
right.
also need the lecture. You can't just have the textbook. You need the lecture that runs alongside it.
Mm-hmm.
So we got the Torah and we got like the running oral commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And he was called Torah Shebaal Peh. Oh, so in college, I was learning a lot of that.
Okay.
Kind of like the depth and the inner essence of a lot of the things that Jews do, like keeping kosher. I was starting to learn why and how that even works, and things like Shabbat, where all these what looks like restrictions, where they come into play, and why you're not allowed to necessarily do things like creative work on Shabbat,
mm-hmm.
and things that I'd kind of been doing my whole life just because my parents had did it, or it's just things that my teachers at school were telling me to do. I never necessarily understood on my own why those things were true. And then in college, towards the end of my college, I started learning about it and realizing that they all have sources, there's all depth to it, there's all, you know, beauty, there's spiritual aspects to it. I found as I was learning, like, I was just enjoying life more and I was starting to understand things that I've always been doing my whole life. So after college, I graduated a semester earlier than most of my friends. So after college, I decided to go back to Israel now and take my time there a little more seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a yeshiva called Eish HaTor in Jerusalem, right next to the Western Wall. I was supposed to just go there for a couple months and really and invest in terms of studying and trying to get some clarity in things in my life. And then soon after I got there, I realized that there's actually a lot more things to learn than I thought. I thought maybe, oh, just go for 3, 4, 5 months and learn and come back and that'll be that.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I got into my studies, the more I saw that there's really an infinite amount of Torah, Jewish mm-hmm. things to learn. In fact, the Talmud, the oral law, I was talking about compares Torah to the ocean.
So that's actually what I was about to ask you, because I know you mentioned the Torah multiple times, and that's like the writing, and that's like the teacher in this example.
Right.
What is the, how would you reference the Talmud is the oral representation or the kind of oral accompaniment? Like the lecture, as in the example you were giving?
Exactly.
Okay, cool, perfect. So you're saying that when you went back, you were starting to do your research, doing your study,
went
and
back
you found
to
that
college.
When you were back in when you went back to Israel, so you were there only intending to be there for a few months, really, but then you found that as you were doing more studying, as you were seeing more, as it was kind of opening, I guess, the realm of possibilities as to what you could learn from this, you were much more compelled to move forward with your studies.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really interesting, and I'd kind of like to hear more about that, because that's really compelling to me as well. As someone who is seeing it from a very outside perspective,
right.
And hearing what you have to talk about, it's really interesting to hear and really kind of encouraging almost to see that something that you thought was so good becoming almost even better in your
right.
eyes as you learn more about it.
Yeah. And that's really, that is like the journey of life. And
mm-hmm.
in terms of like a Jewish life, the more you learn, the more you get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really like anything in life, like the more you put into it, the more you'll get out of it.
Absolutely.
Right? So that was really kind of what was happening with my studies, that I was starting to learn and just get immersed in Jewish values
mm-hmm.
and Jewish studies. But also like Jewish philosophy. There's many facets of Jewish things to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So, like we mentioned, maybe like there's Jewish law and there's just like a way you're in this things like keeping kosher and keeping Shabbat. But then there's also like Jewish philosophy, which mm-hmm. is like, which we have kind of like, for instance, the Jewish philosophy is like, why was the world created? Like from a Jewish perspective, like why was the world created?
Now, out of curiosity, in terms of that sort of subject and focus, what would you say would be like an entry level sort of reading that someone could do if they were curious to get more information about something like that? I know obviously you've got a lot more in-depth information about it, but where would you say maybe you would suggest someone to get started if they wanted to do some reading on that?
This is a good question. There's an author named Aryeh Kaplan. Okay. Aryeh Kaplan. He was like a huge, huge Torah scholar. He knew everything. And he had a, he had a knack for distilling these lofty ideas into an approachable manner.
Okay.
Books that are in English.
Perfect.
If someone looks up Aryeh Kaplan, that would probably be that he has, and he has topics on everything and from like Jewish meditation even, mm-hmm. which really talked about like prayer and what it means for a Jew to pray, to also like, you know, things like what is Israel and specifically Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, why is that such a focus in the Jewish religion? To the like different things about Jewish law, for like mikvah and things like that. So yeah, Aryeh Kaplan's probably a good
neat. Because yeah, one thing that I definitely find, like even especially with like how much you're talking about this and all the different subjects that you can just kind of easily just pick out of your hat of knowledge from like what you know now, it seems that there's a lot of almost like introspection to the Jewish faith and the Jewish teachings and the Jewish like study. It's a lot about like looking at something, really analyzing it, and kind of developing your own understanding of what it means. Because if you look at like say the way you're talking about the Torah and the Talmud, it's like you have to have that accompaniment of your own understanding of it. And a lot of the things that I've heard from people that follow the faith the way you do, like they talk about how there's very specific rabbis or very specific people who have done their research and done their own introspection to the subject and then have been able to talk to the effect of what it means to them and how it's something that should be viewed. I think that's really interesting because when you look at, say, more modern understanding of things, regardless of what the subject is, the more knowledge you have, sometimes it kind of, it's like a double-edged sword. You know, you push with it and it can harm, but it can also harm you if you don't use it in the right way. But I think what's interesting is about this kind of knowledge is it's something that is just greatly beneficial to anyone who learns about it. Because when I look at, say, the examples of, we were even talking about like how like there's certain restrictions, quote unquote, I guess you could say, about like certain days of the year or even on the weekends, like with Shabbat. Some people might not understand it, like, oh, why limit yourself so much or why cut yourself off from so many things that you could be doing? It's like, well, one thing that I really want to touch on, because we talked about it a lot last time, was the idea of delayed gratification and like the idea of kind of stopping yourself from just doing what your impulses tell you to. And I think that that's something that I see is really common and prevalent in especially the Jewish faith, where they have certain things that you shouldn't do, like say eating kosher, but there is a reasoning behind it. Right. There is an explanation behind it. And if people don't want to look at the ideas behind that or kind of accept it, just not even at face value, but accept it and then learn why those things are important. There's like a common concept, I guess. I kind of joke about it with a lot of people, and most people who are parents will get this one, but it's like when you have kids, you tell your kids, you know, don't eat cookies before bed. Right. And most children don't really want to learn about the reason why you don't eat cookies for bed. It's because if you eat the sugar, you're going to be hyper and then you won't sleep well and then your next day will be bad. But you can't really tell someone who's not interested in the reasoning behind something why they should do it because they just don't care. But I think what's neat about, and especially about what you're talking about, is that there's a lot of information that the more you learn about it, and especially in your example, it makes you more interested in learning about it even more. So it's kind of like this rock that's been pushed down a hill, but it's in a good way that you're building up this knowledge, building up this speed in the example that I'm using that kind of elevates your experience. And I'd be curious if you could talk to the effect of that, because obviously it's something that's very important to you and you're a continuously observing person and you learn more and you grow more as an individual. That's something that I think is really interesting. How would you say that it's a kind of, you've talked about how it's affected your life in a very positive way, because when you made that change from being on your own and you're like, you know, I don't have to do this, but I really want to. And then upon doing that, I'm guessing, and even just from what you've kind of said to me, and I'm intuing it from your description, is that you really enjoy and appreciate it.
Right.
And based on your knowledge, how would you say that that's kind of like made you, not to say a better person, but how would you say that it's kind of elevated you as an individual?
Right.
So like with you learning more and having to spend time away from having fun or partying or going on music tours, like you were using in your examples, how would you say that moving in the direction you've moved has benefited you?
So how has it benefited me? So I think I would approach it like this. I might have to like build up an idea.
For sure.
The Jewish approach to everything, like the world, like when I say everything, really it's the purpose of creation, right? Why was the world created, right? So we believe that God is infinite, right? Mm-hmm. So he always was, is, and will be. And before the world was created, right, there wasn't even this thing called time. Like, time is something that was created.
Mm-hmm.
So before anything was created, it was just God. So I guess what the next that would lead to, like, why did God choose to create a world and everything that we see in it, right? And the answer to that, from a Jewish perspective to why the world is created, is because Hashem, God, right, that's what we call God.
That's the reference name, okay. Yeah,
that God created the world to allow something or someone to be able to have a relationship with him. And in that sense, a relationship with the infinite is the greatest pleasure that one could have.
Sure, I can agree with that. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because it's something that, while my perspective on this is radically different than yours, but only because it comes from, like, a much simpler and base understanding of what I claim to believe, is that, like, I think because we're such simple creatures in comparison to something that's infinite and something that's, I guess, in so many words, like, mystical and greater than us, it's something that we look to for inspiration, something that we look to for greatness. And we look at something that's better than we are, not to take away from it or to bring it down to our level, but to aspire for our own element or our own style of greatness. Right. And I think looking at the way you've described it and the exact example you gave, like, we look to build a relationship with God, or we are imperfect creatures, we are flawed in our own ways and we all make mistakes. But when we look at the idea of what's better than us, if we can look at it from an idea of, I want to look to that as how I can improve myself to be closer to this perfect, to be closer to this great being. And I think that's something that a lot of people, again, when we talked about delayed gratification, they're like, I want now. Right. It's like, well, you know, if you do this thing and you wait, or if you do this thing and you consider what it means, it will develop a greater understanding of who you are, what's going on around you. Right. And I think that's really interesting, the way that you attributed it to, like, how we have this relationship that is made for us, and we can choose how we interact with it. We can choose if it's important for us, we will make it grow. I was just actually talking to
I guess what's cool is that we don't have to, like, hypothesize what would having a relationship like what we would need to do to have that relationship. Like, for instance, like with you, I would say, like, if I want to have a relationship with you, I could either think of what you might like and then do it for you, or maybe I could just ask you, like, what would you want me to do for you that would make you like me more, or whatever, or just something that you would enjoy. So that's really where the Torah comes in, because God gave the Jewish people the Torah because its values, things to do and things to stay away from, that will intrinsically create a relationship with God.
Okay.
So he's giving us the instructions, say, if you want to have a relationship with me, here are things that you can do, and here are things that you need to stay away from. And by staying away from those things, and by doing the things that you need to do, you will have a relationship with me.
Okay.
So, right. But also just to... Okay, maybe I'll stop there for now. Yeah,
of course. Because I was thinking, like, I look at a lot of things, like, in terms of relationships, I look at things, like, on an integer scale. When I meet any person, I usually start off any sort of interaction with them, regardless of what they look like, what I've heard about them. I try to start everyone off at, like, a 0 point scale. And when I meet them, if we have a positive interaction at the start, it gets them, let's say, 1 point forward. But if it's a negative experience, it's just going to be negative one. But I won't automatically just cut someone off if they go into the negatives.
Right.
I try to do my best to kind of cultivate a relationship, especially if I want it to, or if there's some sort of, not necessarily a benefit to me, but if it makes sense to have a relationship with this person, I will make an effort to try to keep those numbers in the positive. I'll say maybe overlook things that might generate, say, a negative score per se, but I'll also maybe, like, in a guess, like, a, I don't think it's a selfish way, but I think it's more of like a I'm trying to work with, like, positive reinforcement. If someone does something good, I'll appreciate it more. And if someone does something bad, I may not necessarily look at it from, like, oh, you know, this person's awful, I'm just going to write them off. But I'm like, okay, you know, that wasn't so good, but what good maybe could have come from that? Maybe why did that happen? Because when I look at things from my perspective, if I meet someone, and using your example, like, let's say when we first met, if I wouldn't necessarily do something to say, like, oh, you know, what can I do for you that will make you like me? I look at it also from the perspective of, what can I do that would benefit, say, both of us, so that we can both enjoy the experience that we could share. Right. And that's not always an applicable thing. And sometimes you have to say then, oh, you know, I will sacrifice something for this other person to gain enjoyment or maybe like me more. But if you give up something of yourself so that someone else will benefit from it, it's not necessarily like a negative thing. And a sacrifice in that case wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing either. It's something that you may... Let's say, for instance, I have we have the same sort of vision problem, and I have glasses and you don't, but you need to use the glasses, and I might need to use them as well, but they're not necessary for me. If I share my glasses with you, I can't see as well as you can see, but the benefit to you is greater than the loss that I would experience. So in the grand scheme of things, that almost balances itself in a forward shifting momentum. You know, like, it's like a small bad thing, but a great good thing will almost negate the bad thing. Right. And I think that's kind of similar. Like, that's how I'm in understanding a little bit about what you're talking about, because with the idea of, like, the Torah, it's... an explanation of like, you know, this isn't like the rules or you're going to suddenly burst into flame. It's like, you know, do these things because these are things that I like and I appreciate and I want. And these things, don't do them because I don't really like them. And for someone to say, well, I don't care if you don't like them, I'm going to do them anyways. It's like, okay, well, you're just being ignorant about the approach to it. It's not restrictions or rules. It's an idea of these are better and these might be worse. Right. And following that sort of logic, I think it makes a lot of sense to see how the observing element of being a Jew is really about doing the best good you can, because that's the objective and that's the main goal. And I really appreciate that. I think that's interesting.
It's also, I would say, to take it one step further, if a Jew like is doing something that they're not supposed to do, let's say not keeping kosher, right?
Sure.
By not keeping kosher, you didn't really affect God at all.
You affected yourself.
Right. So why would Hashem, let's say, be a little sad? Because he wants us to, he created, the whole world is for us to have the greatest good. And we're really just harming ourselves by doing that. So when he say, if he's saying like, oh, like, here's a Torah, please keep kosher, keep Shabbat, there's things that I want to do to have a relationship with you. By us not doing it, it pains him in the sense that we're not getting the ultimate good. Mm-hmm. But not that we're like, not that he needs us to keep kosher.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying?
Sure. But keeping kosher in and of itself, I mean, even for someone who doesn't really understand the whole core concept of what that means, if they were to look at it from just even a cursory overview of what it means to keep kosher, you're treating yourself better because there's elements of why it's done that benefit you if you follow it. And if you don't...
On a physical level, you mean?
I guess so, in some capacity, because like there's certain things to it that if you eat good food all the time and you have some bad food, it's not necessarily going to just destroy you. But if you have all bad food and then suddenly you have good food, that's almost even bad for you too. Like I'll use a sort of vague example, but I'll bring it back in a moment. It's like if someone who is vegan only eats natural foods, no animal byproducts, they have like, say, like veggie burgers, for instance, their most of their life, but then you like slip a real burger into their veggie burger box and they have it. It's not even that it's bad that they had it. It's that the type of food that they're going to be consuming is then going to be so aggressive on their system because it's so radically different than what their body's used to. It actually would physically affect them, and it might even harm them a little bit because their body is conditioned in a way that, say, can't handle the cholesterol or handle the fats of that sort of style. And their body then would reject it very heavily. But in this example, I think that I'm trying to attribute it to, it's almost like if you follow and respect like the kosher ideals or the way that it's supposed to be done, you're doing good things for yourself.
Right.
There's elements of it that are following like the spiritual ideas that we talked about this last time a little bit too. But I think even just looking at it from like what it means to do those things is a good idea because it's just beneficial.
Right.
And if you don't follow it, it's like you were saying, like it's not that you can't, is that you probably shouldn't. And at the end of the day, that's a lot of things too. There's lots of things that you can do. You can eat soup with a fork, but it doesn't mean you should, you know? And I think like, it's a silly example, but it makes a lot of sense. Like you could do it. It'd just take you a much longer time. At the end of the day, it's not about doing it with a fork to sort of prove someone, oh, you know, I ate soup with a fork, go me. It's like, you know, if you ate it with a spoon, you could be done and then be doing other things with your life. Like why waste your time? It's like if someone presents to you suggestions about how to live your life in a better way, there's not really someone like taking from you by saying, you know, do this thing instead of this thing because this is a better idea, this is a worse idea. And I think that's kind of like the misconception a lot of people have with the idea behind it.
Well, I guess something that I would want to emphasize is because you were touching upon like the benefits of keeping kosher maybe, right? But it's very important, I guess for anyone who's hearing this and just to know from a Jewish perspective that even if, like, I know, like, these days, you know, like, they say, like, oh, the importance of keeping kosher, like, even in a secular way, it's like, oh, like, people, I think I've heard that people only keep kosher. Like, someone who's secular, not even Jewish, might keep kosher because they hear it's healthier, right? Or, like, I think there's also a study out there to, like, turn your phone off for one day a week. Have you heard of something like this?
Yeah.
So, like, it's nice that Jews do that. But even if there was no physical type of benefit, like, let's say someone said that, no, keeping kosher actually has no benefit, right? On a physical sense.
Right.
Then we would still do it because, and this is an important point, that a principle of Judaism is that we're composed of a body and a soul. So, and they're together. And pretty much what happens after a person passes away is that the body goes in the ground and begins to decompose and the soul goes back upstairs. So even if we can't see the physical benefits of something like keeping kosher, which is cool because you can, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
but even if you couldn't,
right?
A lot of the mitzvahs are for our soul's benefit. And that type of thing can't be understood or studied in this world. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, keeping kosher light. I don't think they'll be able to be research done on the benefit of keeping kosher in regards to a person's soul. That can't really be...
Yeah, because it's not something that you can measure accurately, right, exactly. In the same way that you can measure the physical impact on the body.
Right.
But I think almost it's like saying, if you have a fancy car and you put the cheap gas in it, it's not good for the car. But, well, that's like a bit of a vague example because, like, the driver of the car isn't the soul of the car. Those are two very detached things. I think the kind of point that I was trying to speak to, and maybe I'll ask another question in a second, but, like, I think that the idea behind, just because it's not something that I follow as well as maybe I should, but I wonder then, and actually, you know what, I will ask my question. Do you think that there is a physical benefit to keeping kosher? In your opinion, I mean, because, like,
I guess I never looked into it so well, but... Yeah, why not?
I'd be curious to see if that, maybe I'm going to do my own little research, I guess, because I feel like based on what I know from my understanding of it, it seems to make sense to me that if you were to keep kosher, it would have some sort of physical benefits on your body because it restricts you from, say, maybe some worse things or bad things. But even the idea of, like, say, on Shabbat, there's no technology, there's no sort of creation. I think I kind of tie that into the idea of, like, on the seventh day, God rested. And I think that's almost, is that maybe I'm wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but, like, on a day where you can just stop all the busyness in your mind and your brain and your body, you can stop and kind of reconstitute yourself by, like, eliminating all these distractions and elements that are in your life that maybe don't benefit you or those around you by, say, instead, I know, like, the Jews that I know that when they observe Shabbat and they follow it, they spend that time with the people they love, the people they care about, and they do things that, even if you weren't someone who practices and you hear, like, that's what we did on the weekend as Jews, it's like, no, that's really nice. That's such a nice thing. And even if it's done for a faith-based reason or just even a reason that you want to, say, enjoy your time with those you care about, both of those things, while they're separate from one another, are inherently good.
Right.
And I think that's kind of the important thing that I look at it from. Because when I see, like, one other question that I want to talk to you about, and I think it's really interesting because everyone that I've ever met, everyone that I know that is Jewish, has a really positive outlook on virtually everything that we talk about, insofar that when I hear people be critical or negative of Jews, I'm like, you must be coming from a place that is purely ignorant to what these people are, what these people believe, what these people follow, what these people appreciate. Because, and again, maybe I'm just lucky. Maybe I've met all of the really good Jews. But I think in every sort of way of the world, like, there's always good and bad people in every sort of, in sort of every group. But everyone that I've met and everyone that I've talked to and everything that I've understood and heard, even just even this brief conversation, just sounds like good principles, good ideas, and trying to be the best person you can be. And for someone to be really super critical of that, is someone who I think is just, we're talking about the idea of, like, looking to God as the perfect being, and we're imperfect creatures, and we could look at someone that's better than we are, greater than we are, and say, you know, I hate that thing for being better than I am, or I hate that for having more than me. But you could also say, you know, I like that thing has something that I want as well.
Right.
And those are the two things that are different. We talked about this briefly last time, the victim and victor mentality.
Right.
You can look at a relationship that someone else has and appreciate it and say, that's great. I look to that and I admire it. You know, people who have, if someone's parents have a great marriage and a great relationship, and you think, you know what, when I grow up and I get married, I want to emulate my parents' marriage. Right. Or I look at two friends that I know and they have a great relationship. I want to have a friendship like that. Or you can look at two friends that you have and be like, I'm jealous of those people. And if you look at it from this place, like, I don't want them to be friends. I want to be friends with one of them or both of them better than they are together. Right. That's destructive. And that doesn't really benefit anyone in general. Maybe it benefits you, but that becomes really selfish. But I think when we're looking at, just bringing my example back to, like, the core of it, when we look at the ideas and the principles behind all this stuff, it's mostly about doing the best you can, not only for yourself, but for everyone that's around you to elevate the experience, I guess, of life.
For sure.
Yeah.
Also, I guess a theme would be, it's in terms of, like, what Judaism's about, is emulating God. That's really what it comes down to. Because, and it ties into what we were saying originally about the purpose of creation was for man to have a relationship with God, which is the ultimate good.
Right.
Right? If you think of any relationships that you have with friendships or with anyone, right, the closer you'll feel with someone, you'll feel closer with someone the more similar you are to them.
Right. I agree. And I totally agree with you.
Of course, you have the concept of opposites attract, but not, you can't be opposite on everything.
Right? Right.
The more similar people are, the more they'll have things to talk about and the more they'll be able to relate to each other.
Definitely.
And if you think of any relationships that you've been friends with someone and then moved away, it's probably because your differences have increased and there's less common ground. So that's really where a lot of the commandments and things like that come from, and Jewish values. It's all about emulating God. By emulating God, you become more like him, and therefore you're able to have a higher relationship with him.
Totally, yeah.
So that's really the whole point of it all.
I would agree with that for sure. One thing that I read recently that I thought was interesting, because like I know like the very common idea of the commandments, like the Ten Commandments, but yeah. I read recently that in the Jewish faith there's about 613, yeah. if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. That's really interesting. And I think, would you say then that the Ten Commandments are kind of like a hyper-condensed version of the 613?
So I wouldn't necessarily say that. First of all, it's interesting to say the Ten Commandments, because really within the Ten Commandments, there's really 12 commandments.
Okay.
Which is interesting, because really the 12, the reason why we have these, we'll just call them the Ten Commandments,
sure.
right? But the reason why we have the Ten Commandments, it's more mission statements.
Okay.
That's really the way that I understand them. That these are like core Jewish values mm-hmm. that you need to be on board with. And then once you get on board with the big picture, there's a bunch of other nuances that need to be incorporated into your life to be able to have the highest level relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And if you think of any type of like professional, like athlete or singer, right? It's really the nuances that separate, you know, the average players from the professionals,
mm-hmm.
right? So while we might have had the Ten Commandments, right? We now have 613, well, I guess 613 minus the 10 or the 12, right? We have like a couple hundred other ways of emulating God. Like
okay.
If you think of the Ten Commandments, right? One of them is the first ones to know that God exists.
Right.
Right? So that is the ultimate relationship that you're now putting your mind in a place of acknowledging that there's a God.
That's exactly the thought right? that I just had, like acknowledging that there is something
right.
that you have to then attribute yourself to. The aspiration right. for greatness is the first step
right.
in moving in that direction. Because if you don't believe in that element right. of it, there's no point in really following right. the rest, because that's how it starts.
Right.
Okay, cool.
And then after that, follow just a bunch of, I guess what's even within the other Ten Commandments or something like keeping Shabbat, mm-hmm. right? Keeping Shabbat is also a huge one, because God rested on the seventh day. But if a Jew's whole life is meant to emulate God, then that's what we do. God mm-hmm. rested on the seventh day, so we're going to rest on the seventh day too. And that's why we're not able to do, that's why one of the prohibitions on Shabbat is to not do any type of creative work.
Right, that makes sense, following the same idea, yeah.
Right, but there's an added nuance to, mm-hmm. to keeping Shabbat and not doing creative work, in the sense that when God finished creating the world, the Torah, the Bible, the five books, right, it says that he looked at the world and it was good, it was very good, and then he rested, right? Which means we understand that nothing else needed to be done,
mm-hmm.
right? So for us to emulate God by resting on the seventh day, it wouldn't be enough to just stay in bed and not do anything, right? We also need to make sure that we're not doing any type of creative work, for instance, mm-hmm. making a fire, right? That because that would show that even though God, you know, God thought the world was done with creation, we're now going to go ahead on the day where he rested and create more. It's kind of a contradiction.
For sure. Right? I can appreciate that and understand it. Yeah, because it's like, you know, it was set up in a way that was, after 6 days, everything was done, everything was set up, it's good.
Right.
There's nothing else that needs to be done. So to do more right. is to almost not, maybe I'm looking at this from a different perspective, but it's like to do more would be to say good work, but not enough.
Right, exactly.
Almost. Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then how would you say, okay, I guess, so yeah, that kind of covers the main point of it, because once you follow at least the first sort of idea and you kind of take them step by step, they kind of speak to the effect of each other.
Right.
And I think that's one of the interesting things, because a lot of people, and again, I keep bringing the subject up, like the idea of delayed gratification. People will look at, like, in the example of Shabbat, like, you don't have to follow these things, but if you do this, it's emulating emulating God, and that is the real ideal. It's if you don't do it, the world's not going to end, it's not going to be a disaster, but if you want to emulate yourself in the image of what you're aspiring to do that thing is the right thing that you should be
right.
doing. It's not a mandatory thing, but it's a suggestion that if you follow it, it will benefit you right. in the way that it brings you closer in that relationship.
Right.
Interesting. I really like that. I think there's one more thing that I kind of wanted to look at.
Yeah. Also, if I could just add something in.
Yeah.
I like that you keep bringing up the delayed gratification, because there's an aspect of this relationship with God and the purpose of creation that I've been talking about
mm-hmm.
that I've left out
okay.
in a sense, and it ties into your delayed gratification. When I talk about the purpose of creation being having a relationship with God, that relationship will really only be tangible.
Mm-hmm.
Not, I shouldn't use the word tangible, but it's going to be magnified when a person passes away and their soul goes up now to heaven,
mm-hmm.
right? Because that's when our spiritual sense will be able to connect, it kind of plugs in to this relationship with God.
Right.
Right now, it's very much like dulled down. We can't really sense it so much because we live in a physical world. But once our soul goes up to a world that's entirely spiritual, then all the work that we did down here to put our soul on the right track by keeping kosher and having a relationship with Hashem and things like that, now when our soul goes back up, it's this nicely prepared vessel to kind of plug right into having a relationship with God.
Okay.
So that's really, I guess, why when you say delayed gratification, makes me think of that, because that is really the whole of the a Jew's life, that the ultimate gratification is going to be in the next world when our relationship with Hashem can be magnified. But that doesn't mean that we're not getting any gratification in this world.
Because
if that is the ultimate gratification, then it's going to make sense that the ripple effects of that, that we'll be able to sense on a somewhat lower level down here, will also be the greatest good. If that's the greatest good, then this is going to be the greatest good in this world as well, having a relationship with God, just that it gets magnified up there.
Yeah, like there's a joke that a lot of people will throw out, which is, I think, almost preposterous beyond anything that I've ever heard. People will say, like, oh, you know, if it's so good to rejoin God and go to heaven, why don't you just kill yourself now? And it's such a preposterous thought to have, because it's like, well, the goal isn't to just get there as fast as possible. The goal is that we've been created in this way, and maybe this is just my understanding of it, we've been created in a way that allows us the opportunity to be good people and to emulate what the greatest good is. And in the time that you have on this earth, spend as much of it as you possibly can being a good person, doing good things. There's a show that Bethany and I are watching.
I guess it would tie into the reason why you need to do that is because when someone then does pass away, now he's put his soul in a position where it could plug into spirituality.
Yes, but not even, I think you could probably speak more to this than I would, that it's not then, this is your just reward, like you don't do these things to get something out of it. Because like, if you give someone
that's
a gift.
That's such a good point, because the point of heaven and hell in Judaism, it's not reward and punishment. It's more viewed as a result. Meaning, in this world, did you have a relationship with God? Mm-hmm. If the answer is yes, then when you pass away, you will naturally have a relationship with God, because that's the position you put yourself in. And if the answer is no, then when your soul is allowed an opportunity to have a relationship with God, spirituality won't speak to it, because you didn't put your soul in a position.
It wasn't an important thing for you. Because if it is something that's important to you, like when you do something expecting something in return,
right,
it kind of negates the benefit of whatever that thing was. Like,
right,
there's a show that Bethany and I are watching right now, and it's kind of like, not really a parody, but like the joke of it, the main point of it is called The Good Place. And what it is the main character in this show is this like...
Is it a TV show?
TV show, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pretty funny. You might get a kick out of it if you watch it, but I recommend it to all kinds of people because I think it's really funny. But the main character in the show is like very selfish, very self-indulgent, lives a life of just kind of doing things only for herself. And then she dies. And she goes to this place called The Good Place, and it's essentially like heaven. And what happens is she meets with this individual who's kind of like the architect of this neighborhood, which is the afterlife. And they have rated her whole life based on all her interactions with people, all her actions she's done, on an integer scale, kind of like what I was talking about earlier. And all her good deeds gave her a positive number, and she had the best number possible that got her into this heaven place. But the joke of the movie or the show is that her name is the same name as another person who did all the good deeds that they claim she did. But because she's such a selfish person, she's like, oh yeah, totally, that was 100% me. I deserve to be here. But then things start happening in the show that kind of make her understand that, you know, everything that's happening around her is because she's in a place that she shouldn't be, because she didn't focus her attributes and her lifestyle to being a really good person, but she's now benefiting from someone else who was really good that she's just kind of stealing from them. And I think the idea of like, so what ends up happening in the show that I thought was interesting was she meets a person and she wants to try to become better. But she wants to become better so she doesn't get kicked out of this place.
Right.
So doing all these good things that she does so that she doesn't get caught in this good place because she's a bad person actually negate any sort of benefit she could have as a good person, because she's only trying to get a reward from her actions.
Right.
So it's like this element of doing things because you want something in return is super selfish, and it's not the way that things should be done. It's like when we do something for someone, it's because we do it out of the goodness of our heart.
Right.
We do it because it emulates this greater concept of who we are as a person. And I think that's really interesting. Like, we've talked about it a lot in a number of different ways, and that kind of, that's the way that I bring it back into one idea. If you do something because it will benefit someone, and even if it takes away from you, it's not about worrying like, what will I get out of this as well? It's about how can I be the best person I can.
For sure.
And I think, yeah, that's...
And that would be the ideal level in a Jew's life in this world, is to do the commandments and have a relationship with God just because you love him so much. Mm-hmm. As opposed to saying, oh, I'm doing this because I want a reward in return. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, again, that's not a relationship.
Right.
And therefore, it's you're not going to get the ultimate relationship. Mm-hmm. By kind of like by having bad intentions.
Well, it's right? Like you missed the mark almost entirely there. Right. Like if you
but
do
there
something,
is, but there is an idea in Judaism that even if you do something like let's say for instance Shabbat, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard for someone to tap into Shabbat. Let's say right, someone can't have it's hard for him. He'd rather be on his phone, right? So there's an idea that you know make really good food for him, so he'll be into it, right? So he's not doing Shabbat right now to have a relationship with God. He's really doing it for the food. But there is a big idea that's still very positive, because eventually what he's doing for the wrong intentions will eventually transition into doing something with the proper intentions. So there is this idea of like kind of like working within reality,
right?
And like kind of like talking to people's temptations, so that once they're in, they're, you know, as time goes on, their values will become a little more.
Interesting. I like that. I like that example because that makes a lot of sense. Like almost
natural.
we see a lot of times now. Yeah, very natural. Very natural for sure. I'd agree with that, because one thing that we see a lot nowadays with like parents who have kids that they don't know how to interact with or deal with or parent really, they're like, oh, here's an iPad or here's a device that you can just put in your face and be distracted. And I don't have to work as being a parent to keep your attention. Otherwise, you'll scream, you'll yell, you'll run around, because I, as a parent who has a child, am selfish and want to do other things at the same time as having a child. It's like, you know, you may want to go watch a movie, or you may want to go see friends, or you may want to go do this or go do that, right. But you have a child, so then you're, oh, I have a kid. It's like, well, it's not, oh, I have a kid. It's, I have a child. I now have a responsibility that I have to do, and it may not allow me to do other things that may have freedom to them, or I may not be as free to go do whatever I'd like, but... Talking again, and I bring this up so many times because I think you really emphasize this as an ideal, is like delayed gratification. Like, you want to go to the movies? Okay, hire a babysitter, or wait till your child is old enough to go to the movies too. Or you know what? Don't see it in the theater. Watch it at home when your child is asleep. There are certain things that you have to
and what's
sacrifice.
The delayed gratification?
And the delayed gratification there is, you know, you want to go to the movies, you want to enjoy the experience, but you have a child. Okay, well, maybe you don't get to go to the movies, but you get to watch it at home later in the evening when it comes out on DVD. You don't do the thing that you want based on your impulses because now there's some sort of barrier or blockade. Right. You look at them as opportunities to build yourself up and grow as a person. It's not about
delayed gratification would be then raising a good child.
Yes,
that's what.
Yes, because like when these parents are just throwing their kids into this world of social media or games or what have you, can you imagine having kids as like an observing Jew and then being like, oh, you know, on this day you guys can't even look at the phone. They're gonna be like, what are you talking about? No way, like I need to have my phone. I'm a kid who's obsessed with video games. It's like, nope. Yeah. And how do you explain it to them when the same ideals that you have aren't the same the ones that they share? Yeah. And I think like that's something that's...
Observant homes usually have a very low emphasis on TV
yeah.
and movies.
But I think even that's like an important thing too, because those things, while they're enjoyable and they're fun, like I remember when I was a kid,
they're distracting.
They do distract you, but we also did things that when I was younger, like we didn't really have like, I remember getting the internet as a kid. I'm sure you probably remember the same sort of thing as well. But like before then,
was it the dial up?
Oh AOL. Man, AOL. Someone picks up the phone, you're like, no, everything I'm doing, it's over. And it's such a crazy thing to think about, because like we would go out and like, I'd play road hockey with my friends, or we'd go climb trees or whatever. We just did kid stuff. Yeah. But now it's like, we live in this world that's so much more complicated and so crazy with how many things that are happening around it. Like, going back to that idea of the show that I was telling you about, they have a thing where they start looking at how people get points for doing good things. But let's say you go to the store and you buy a tomato because it's, and you want to make food for someone, but you bought a tomato that was picked by slave labor, but you didn't know that because you didn't do your research about what brand of tomato you were buying and where that brand is situated in. But now things are so complicated. It's not so much that you can go out to your own garden that takes time and work to tender and make profitable. You have to then go and cut your corners. You have to do things that are easier because you have so many other responsibilities. Life is complex, and however we live it isn't necessarily going to be about what we do as an action towards other people. It's trying to do less bad in the grand scheme of things is the easiest thing that people can do now. If someone makes a conscious choice, you know, oh, maybe, you know what? Maybe I don't do that thing. Maybe I do this thing instead. I won't get the instant gratification, or I won't get like this immediate pleasure out of what I'm doing, but I'm not taking from someone else. Yeah. And maybe this lesser good is, in fact, a greater good, because it's it's less bad as well. And sure, it kind of amplifies what that thing is. One other thing that I kind of wanted to ask about, because we talked about the main things that I really thought about, I really wanted to ask you about a bit about your background. I want to talk about delayed gratification and like responsibility in today's society. What do you think the main differences might be regarding the emotional connection or a logical connection to faith? Because we talked about this a bit last time I met you, and we both sort of had this element where the logical conclusion that you take anything to is the best way to understand it. And when you were talking to me about how the books were given to the Jews and they have this knowledge of what things mean and why they follow these rules because of something they could point at, I think that's really important because once you show someone something, you explain the detail of it, even at a base level, there's no way to really refute that point. And when you explained it to me last time, and I won't go into the full details unless you have like a way that you can kind of Cole's notes it or paraphrase it, I understood it immediately. It made a lot of sense. And it wasn't something that I was like going to be skeptical of because there's not necessarily no room for skepticism. Anyone can be a skeptic. You can say you believe in that and then throw it into any direction you want. Sure. But if you're willing to accept something, I think at its face value, because it sounds at least reasonable and you don't look for the holes in something, you want to appreciate it for what it is. I think that that sort of bridges this gap between an emotional connection and a logical connection. And I wonder if you could speak sort of that connection as well.
So in terms of the logical connection, right, there's a verse in the Torah, in one of the five books, that says that you need to know about God, right? And then bring it to your heart. It says, V'yadata hayom, know about this thing, know it this day, V'yashivota levavecha, and then bring it to your heart and have an emotional connection. And I think it ties into, it's exactly what you're saying, because if that which you're believing in and having an emotional connection with isn't based on something that you really understand, then you're not really able to have an emotional connection with it because there's no foundation there, right? So that's really where Judaism, you know, comes in strong, in the sense that, right, I was talking about how Moshe got the Torah at Mount Sinai and he gave it to the Jews, and in the Torah it has a bunch of ways that we could live our life, right, and have a relationship with Hashem. But what was unique about the way that the Torah was given over to the Jews is that it was done in a mass revelation type of way, that there was about 2 million people standing around Mount Sinai, and they heard God speak to them. At least two of the commandments they heard from God's mouth, so to speak, right? And the rest was given over as through Moses as like a middleman. But something that the entire Jewish people heard was God. God revealed himself to all more or less 2 million people. And then Moshe gave them the Torah, right? So what's cool about this is that something like this is hard to be refuted, in the sense that it's not one person coming and saying, oh, I have this book that God gave to me, here, read it. It's 2 million people realizing together that God just gave them something, right? So I guess I brought this, it's a Torah. I usually don't quote like verses. You know, I feel like
no, I'd love it if you would.
But I feel like it'll hammer in this idea, right? So it comes from, and then I want to do like a little experiment, I guess,
for
with
sure.
You know what I mean? But it says, it talks about, it's at the end of the book of Deuteronomy, right? Mm-hmm. Chapter 4, verse 33, where the background to these verses is talking about, like, you know, when the Jewish people enter the land of Israel and your children will inquire about God and things like that, like how are parents supposed to respond to them, right? So it says that that's something that you could tell the generations is something like this, right? So it's chapter 4, verse 33. It says, has something that a parent's supposed to tell their child is, have people ever heard the voice of God speaking from the midst of the fire, talking about Mount Sinai, the way you did and survived? Has any God ever miraculously taken for himself a nation from amidst another nation, talking about taking the Jews out of Egypt, with challenges and with signs and with wonders, talking about the 10 plagues, right? Mm-hmm. With war, the way he took them out and he drowned the Egyptians in the sea, when he split the sea with a strong hand, with an outstretched arm, with awesome deeds, the way that God did for you and your Egypt before your eyes? You have been shown so that you know that God, Hashem, is your God. There's no one besides him.
Okay.
Right, so this, the verse I just read to you are in the actual Torah. This is in one of the five books. So this book was given to the Jews, right? So imagine if I gave you a book and it said something like I just read that imagine I gave you a book saying you heard God speak to you. What would you say, right?
Interesting. Yeah. If it had been for my experience, I don't really necessarily know how I would respond to it, because if I had been in that sort of circumstance and in that position, it's, I don't know. That's really interesting.
I guess the point I was trying to say is if that didn't happen to the person who's receiving the book, they would reject it.
For sure.
right? It must be that the person who, that the people that got this book, and when they read this, it says, oh, God spoke to you and he took you out of Egypt and he, you know, with the plagues, it must be that when they read this, they say, yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
if that okay. never happened,
right.
then.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. I understand.
Wouldn't believe it.
I guess that's the question that I wanted to ask too. And I almost might even like kind of sort of maybe end on this sort of question. Because like a lot of people will say like, oh, like, how do you know that happened? Like, right. what's the point of that story? It's like, well, you know, what if it happened? If it happened, that's a good thing because right. it shows that there's some connection that we have to a greater power.
Right.
And if it didn't happen, and this is what other people are following, there's nothing really bad about that. But let's follow the idea that it did happen. Right. And this good thing is resulting from it.
Right.
That is inherently good. Yeah. There's nothing that you can criticize of it. And if you do, it's almost just being like a pessimist for no right. reason. It's like, right. you know, the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. I've always looked at the idea of if you look at a cup of water that has 50% water in it, the other 50% is air. The glass is always 100% full because they're the same thing. They're just in different states. Yeah. And talking again about I guess that exact example would be really perfect because if we look at the body and the soul as two connected things that yeah. when one leaves and the other goes, yeah. they are of the same sort of nature. They come from a similar place. God created both of them and put them they join them together, but then one returns to the place of its right. origin. And I think if you look at like the idea of water in a physical state versus right. water in a gaseous state, so water and air are the same thing. The air we breathe is the same as the water we would drink, nice. But they exist in a different sort of paradigm. And I think that's something that's really important because when someone says like, oh, like if it's true, so what? Or if it's not true, right. so what? It's like, those are not the right questions to ask. It's what do they mean? And how will they right. benefit people? Because if we follow those ideas and we follow those principles, good things happen. Nothing bad comes from those things. Right. So it's like, why negate that experience? Why look at it from a perspective of like, oh, who cares? Or yeah. what's the point? It's like, those are the wrong questions to ask. And I think that's why when I look at just even thinking about how much like time you've spent focusing and studying and researching this and how many other people have spent time focusing and studying and researching this, better things come from those that idea and looking into that stuff. More good comes from that right. than bad will ever come from it.
Right.
And I think that's a really interesting thing that comes yeah. that's kind of being generated by that.
Right. And I guess something I would want to add though, because yeah. your question before was kind of two-sided, like the logical and the emotional point
sure.
of view. So I think the reason it's so important to have such a confident stance on the fact that this revelation that the Jews heard God speak and, mm-hmm. and got the Torah from them, the reason why it's so powerful is because then when you get to the commandments, the 613, and you come across something like kosher,
right.
which at first you might not understand, at least you could be clear that, you know, I might not understand something like Shabbat and kosher right now, but I do know that God gave me this commandment. And therefore, even if I don't understand it, I could appreciate that there's something beyond my understanding, right?
For sure.
And then once you're based on confidence and logic, you can now begin to invest yourself and learn about things like kosher and Shabbat, mm-hmm. and then get an emotional connection with it. And that's a real emotional connection when it's based on an intellectual point of view.
For sure. I think like one of my favorite quotes that I say it all the time, because it's almost like a self-deprecating quote, but I think it's important for people to understand, is like, all I know is that I know nothing at all. And it's a quote by Socrates. And I think it's interesting to be like, because most people will say like, oh, I'm informed on this, I'm informed on that, or I know this, or I know that. But it's really about what you don't know and how you learn about that thing. Okay. Because in this exact example, like you could, the less you know about something, and the less of an experience you have with something, the better you can be off when you start to learn about it. Because we have a lot of things like, and I'll use this example, but it's a little vague, but I think it kind of relates. So we have a lot of processes that we do at the work that I do. I work at Amazon, and we have people that come in and say, oh, I'm so bad at this. That's so difficult. I say, you're not bad. You are bad at this, but only because you don't know what you're doing. Yeah. And they kind of laugh awkwardly. They're like, haha. And yeah. they think that I'm insulting them. And I'm saying, no, I'm not denigrating your experience. What I'm saying is you don't know what you're doing, which means that you can now learn how to do the
nice.
Thing.
Yeah.
Don't think of it from a perspective of... Yeah, don't think of it from a perspective of like, I'm going to be bad at this. Right. Just think, I could be good at this.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we need to really do with our lives. Man, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. I really appreciate it. It's. I think I ended it with a quote. If you have something that you think is really kind of insightful, I'd love to hear kind of like the last thoughts that you have on the...
A few last thoughts. Listen, I would say, I guess if there's any like Jewish listeners out there, right, that about at the end of the 1940s, mid-1940s, right, the Second World War ended, and pretty much that began to spiral the Jewish religion into untrespassed area, in the sense that before World War II, there was always this continuation of knowledge that my ancestors had heard God speak to their ancestors at Mount Sinai, and it's been passed down. After the Holocaust, the state of the Jewish people kind of got into shambles, and that's why recently we have a lot of Jews that don't even have a connection with God or with their religion at all, because of something like the Holocaust that shook it up and caused people to totally just not pass on Jewish values for the first time in history. But now we do find ourselves in the Jewish perspective in like a Renaissance area where there's like a lot of schools and facilities where people who have been brought up not having Jewish knowledge and kind of just being more or less just unknowledgeable in a lot of Jewish ideas, there's schools and there's places where they go where they can begin to learn about it and understand the things that their ancestors, maybe their grandparents or their great-grandparents, cherished so well. So if I guess if anything that I've been saying resonates with any listeners out there, then there's places in Israel and there's places in America, a place like Eisha Torah, a place like Or Sameach, where they can begin and ask questions, and they can begin to, you know, see the richness of their heritage.
And I know you talked to me, this is actually where I'll definitely end it, because I think we talked about this last time, and you said that you do a, I don't know really how to describe it, like a service where you help Jews return to Israel so they can experience what it means to really be part of that community.
Right. And to study Torah.
And where could someone look up information about that if they really want to see how to reconnect with their roots and really kind of reaffirm themselves?
So the Eisha Torah website, I think it's just eishatorah.com, or maybe it's eish.com. That's the school that I go to. What else? There's a website called partnersintorah.com. That's another one that sets you up with like a study partner. I'd say those two. What else would it be? Well, let's leave with those two. There's partnersintorah.com, there's aish.com, and if anyone wants to reach out to me, they could email me.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'll make sure your info's on here.
Email. Okay, awesome.
Awesome, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So this is going to be an extra segment that I wanted to include with my lovely wife, because she mentioned this last time we were having a conversation, and I think it was interesting and it's worthy to include because it makes a lot of sense. Hi, Bethany.
Hello.
You were talking with Asif last time we were hanging out regarding the idea of free will, and you mentioned something to me that you said to him that he found was really profound, and I was wondering if you could speak to the effect of what it was that you and him kind of had a conversation about and what it was you said, because when you said it to me, I really liked it and I really enjoyed it and I thought it made a lot of sense, but I'm not remembering it in its exact verbiage, so I was hoping you could kind of reiterate what your main point was and how you kind of related it to what you guys were talking about.
Okay, so we were talking about like Torah, Bible things, and basically we were talking about how you have such a greater choice, or it's more meaningful when you have the free will to choose something. So God giving us free will to choose to follow him, to serve him, is much more significant than if God just made us like robots that automatically loved him. So it's just a more meaningful interaction. But on another point, we were just discussing of how important we as humans and our earth and our planet and everything that he's put on it is so important to him, but us specifically, versus the rest of the galaxy. And I point out that in the very beginning of the Bible, which is very similar to what they say in the Torah, is that in the beginning God made the heavens, so the whole entire galaxy, every universe possible, and then the earth. And that is specifically how he gets the author of that segment like to write that, of like he compares the whole world, whole galaxy and everything else and whatever may be in it to the earth. So just the significance of how God's perspective of us and how we are so, so important to him, I think is that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That is kind of what you were talking about. And I like the way you phrased it, because it does make a lot of sense. Even if someone wants to kind of point at the verbiage there or like what was said and try to like give it with a dose of skepticism, that's their prerogative. But I don't think there's any real point to it, because if that's the belief system that you attribute to what you follow and what you understand, and your willingness to use that as kind of a basis of understanding, I think has only merits in the good ideas. Because, like, let's be frank, where everything is really happening right now. There could be infinite things happening all across whatever the known universe is, but at the end of the day, we are all focusing on ourselves here. We're trying to get off this planet. That's a big common theme now. Everyone wants to get away from here, which is really funny because we don't really have anything else. There's a big joke, and there's kind of an idea that, and I think this was a funny one, that we were initially, Mars was the first planet, and we destroyed it so badly that we went to Earth instead. And it's such like a conspiracy theory or idea that just, it's like, sure, yeah, whatever, maybe that could be true. Maybe. There's nothing really to suggest that is the case, but there's so much more to the idea that, you know, God created the heavens,
and the earth. And it was that the heavens is everything outside of our planet, everything outside of where we are.
Yeah.
And then where we are is the central kind of core place. Like, this is the place.
Yeah, could I
because,
ask something?
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Just more significance to that, of just that we are significant beings. In the second chapter of the Bible, God says he created man, like mankind, in his likeness. He doesn't create anything else in the whole entirety of the universe or the earth to represent him or be in his likeness. So if you wanted to like dive on that further, it can be very, very interesting when you say what does it mean, his likeness, right? So sometimes people can say, you know what, we have attributes of God, essentially, like, you know, like the creative mind, the free will.
And yeah, to speak actually to the effect of that, there's a, I can't remember exactly who it was that said it, but there's someone was saying like we have, as humans in God's image, we have transformative properties in how we conduct ourselves. There are things we can do that radically will change the world around us, insofar that other animals, while they live in their environment and they work with it, we change the world around us. And sometimes it's for the better, sometimes it's for the worse. Unfortunately, humans, again, going back to the idea of free will and being able to choose what it is we do, sometimes we'll make mistakes and do things that aren't necessarily the right thing that they should have done. You know, things like when we do mass deforestation or when mass murders occur, those definitely are not what's supposed to happen. But we have this transformative property that likens us to the idea of the great mover or the one who creates. I think it's really interesting. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and maybe even learned something new from it. If you want to join in on the conversation, you can do so in one of two ways. First, go to our website, tinyurl.com/semi-podcast. That's tinyurl.com/semi-podcast with a dash in the middle, and submit any questions you have through the options on there, or download the Anchor app, available for both iOS and Android, on which you can even start your own podcast, and follow the link that I have provided in the description of this episode to either ask a question or maybe even guest star in the future. Until next time, bye for now.